Welcome to the Radio Gemini technical documentary. Side one of this tape contains numerous off-air extracts of Radio Gemini, which are not therefore of the best quality, while on side two you'll find studio quality IDs and promos, which should give an idea of the Gemini sound.
Well, we're calling it the Radio Gemini technical documentary, but we're not going to go into the technicalities that deeply. We're not going to go into circuit diagrams and Pi matching networks and that sort of thing. The maths would bore you, I'm sure. But anyway, it's going to give a general idea of how the station was run and what happened and what we did about it and that sort of thing. Well, it all started in early 1972 when the two of us got together, both being engineers, and we thought it would be a good idea, because of our interest in offshore radio, to start a pirate radio station.
Yeah, now don't forget we also had a very strong interest in the communication side of radio, which of course is important, I think, to keep the interest going.
Yes, we'd done various tests on shortwave and medium wave, come to think of it, with various transmitters of different powers.
Yeah, you very rarely start this sort of thing just from scratch. You've usually got a fairly good background of the whole system. And of course, don't forget as well, we were very interested in the offshore sounds, namely the old days of 1960s, Big Earl and Caroline, and this was a sort of a spark to keep the interest in radio going.
Yeah, and we thought all these tapes we had, hours and hours of offshore tapes from the old days, all our archives, it'd be nice to be able to play them to other people so they weren't just sat there being wasted.
Well, due to our involvement in medium wave radio, we had experience of what you can do on medium wave, namely you can produce programs which people listen to, but we'd also found out that very few people seem to write in to tell you how well you're coming in. I don't know whether this is just a characteristic of medium wave or, you know, the sort of people that you're reaching. But we thought if we were going to get any response to our programs at all which was worth having, we'd have to go to shortwave, where we hoped the area of sort of listeners would be much larger. And also we'd hoped that the type of people listening in would be more prone to writing in to tell you how well the program was being heard. And at that time, R&I had a DX program on 6210. What time was it running?
It was 9 to 10 GMT on 6210.
9 to 10 on 6210. And of course, we thought, therefore, that if we produced a program on an adjacent channel quite close, the hour later, which would be 10 to 11 GMT, we'd scoop up all the listeners that were listening to the DX program and tuned off when it finished.
Yes, when it went Dutch, in fact. So we'd also been able to obtain a lot of job crystals at a well-known shop in London.
Which we won't mention for various reasons.
No, we're not allowed to advertise. Anyway, they were on a frequency of 6220. And we thought, well, that's just about right. It's about 10 kcs away. It should be far enough away from the splatter of R&I. So that's how it all began. It was Radio Gemini on 6220.
Initially, a multi-purpose transmitter, which had been built sometime before, was adapted to work in the 49-metre band, and I think it had a power of about 60, 65 watts.
Yeah, 65 watts with the old faithful 807 PA.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so we got together one evening and decided to start making the programme, which would form the first test transmission. We wanted to make it as interesting as possible to get as many people as we could to write in, so we thought we'd base it around records, not so well-known records, not just top 10 like everyone else played, but not so well-known records, a few foreign records, say Dutch records, that sort of thing, and offshore extracts, which we would call gems, fitting in with the station name Gemini, of course.
Indeed, and we decided that a period of 1 hour was quite adequate, because mainly we didn't want to risk getting caught. 1 hour seemed quite good to start at the beginning, and we had to make the programmes with our sort of limited studio facilities by stopping and starting tape recorders, and anything over an hour would have taken just far too long to make.
Yeah.
Yes, most people don't realise, in fact, how long it takes to make a Radio Gemini programme. It takes about 8 to 10 hours at least to make the 1 hour show. This is basically because all the items that we need are not sort of readily available, not like you're doing a top 10 show where you just have to have 10 records and your sort of voice and that's it, really. When you're making a show like ours, you have to have all the offshore gems and all the bits which are found on various tapes available, and you simply can't have these at hand because you'd have to have hundreds of different tape recorders. So each item's recorded piece by piece, and this is what takes the time.
We have to play through them, in fact, beforehand to decide which bits we're going to use, and when we've decided, we actually sort of butt join it onto the show tape, as it were.
Indeed, that's exactly how it's made.
The first programme was duly finished and was transmitted on the first weekend available, which just happened to be Saturday, November the 4th, 1972, and Sunday, November the 5th, 1972, and which leads us very nicely into the first extract, in fact, recorded in Stafford in England.
Stafford, of course, being about 100 miles from London, which is where the transmitter was located.
Well, there you are. That was King Radio, K-I-N-G, from 236 metres, from quite some time ago. This is Radio Gemini on 6220 kilohertz in the 49-metre European band. And we'd love to hear from you, so why don't you send in reception reports to our British mailing address of 50 Hempstead Road, Watford, Hertfordshire in England. All reports will be verified, and we'd love to hear from you if you have any ideas for programmes, or content of programmes, perhaps I should say. At the moment we're just running a weekend gem station, thus Gemini, if you see what I mean. So, well, you get those reports rolling in, we'd love to hear from you. This is Radio Gemini, 6220. Beautiful record now from 1967 that never really made it. It's from Rupert's People and it's called Reflections of Charles Brown.
That was recorded in Stafford in Great Britain, and just as a comparison, here's a recording made in Delft, Holland, from about the same period.
Well, that was Radio City on 299 in the medium wave. This is Radio Gemini on 6220 kilohertz in the 49 metre band. And if you'd like to write to us, then the address is 50 Hempstead Road, Watford, Hertfordshire in England. And we'd very much appreciate listener reception reports, and all reports will be verified. That's 50 Hempstead Road, Watford, Hertfordshire in England. A very nice record from Glen Campbell called Wichita Lineman.
I am a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road, sitting in the sun for another
As you notice from the recording there, the signal was fading considerably, which may seem odd now, but it surprised us at the time because we didn't really have much knowledge of atmospheric propagation, and it was due to this that we felt quite sort of safe at the beginning, because we always thought that any signal that was fading must be coming from miles and miles away.
Yeah, and in fact we'd noticed fading as close as 2 or 3 miles away from the transmitter.
Yes, it's a fact that on what we'd call good days, a signal can be returned from the ionosphere vertically, which means that very close to the transmitter you get very severe fading.
Yeah, this is due to the skywave being returned very close to the transmitter, phasing in and out with the ground wave, and this produces very deep fading within, well, as we've said, 2 or 3 miles of the transmitter. And this gave us great confidence because we thought if the post office are picking us up very close, then they would think, as we used to do, that a signal that's fading was coming from miles away, so they couldn't be possibly anywhere near where we were.
We honestly hadn't expected very much response to the programmes and hadn't even bothered to go around to the mailing address to see if there was any mail. But when we did go around a couple of weeks after the first programme went out, we were amazed at how much mail there was. There was such a vast amount compared to sort of medium wave programmes that we were staggered, and we decided virtually there and then that we were going to just keep going, because we simply hadn't had response like this before. So quite soon we had QSL cards printed and headed notepaper printed, which was done ultra fast. I think we had it done within about a week and a half, and the first sort of QSL cards went speeding over Europe very quickly.
Yes, and we were amazed, actually. Within a couple of weeks of being on, we were getting mentioned in programmes such as Sweden Calling DXs and World Music Radio, which is in fact the extract we're going to play you now, from the 17th of December 1972, an extract from World Music Radio mentioning us, Radio Gemini.
Venezuela, unabhängige Radiostation. Radio Gemini zahlt weiterhin mit seinen Sätzen zwischen 10 Uhr und 11 Uhr GMT auf 6220 kHz empfangen werden. Die Empfangsqualität schwankt zwischen gut und schlecht. Es ist jeweils das Leistungsprogramm ausgestrahlt, das unter anderem Mitschnitte von Swinging Radio England, King Radio und Radio City enthält. Zur Erinnerung hier nochmal die Anschrift: Radio Gemini oder im Englischen Radio Gemini, 50 Hempstead Road, Watford, Hertfordshire in England. Ich wiederhole nochmals die Anschrift: Radio Gemini, 50 Hempstead Road, Watford, Hertfordshire in England. OM Hakan Eriksson aus Sunne in Schweden teilte mit, dass...
By now, a second transmitter of 150 watts had been constructed and was in operation, and as the two transmitters were operated from different sites, they were used alternately, one on a Saturday and one on a Sunday, because we were still doing programs on both days. The idea of operating two different transmitters was, of course, quite simply that it reduced the chance of being caught.
Yeah, but very soon we did notice that from the reception reports coming in, most people listened on Sundays. I think people had better things to do on Saturdays. So we decided to reduce the risk even further and not operate on Saturdays. So we carried on 6220 kilohertz on Sundays only, 10 to 11 GMT. And we've got another extract now recorded in Astorp in Sweden on April the 22nd, 1973.
Well, here again is a reminder of our mailing address. That's 5050 Hempstead Road, Watford, Hertfordshire in England. And that's the address to send all your reception reports to, which if you enclose an IRC, they will be verified by a QSL card.
That's right, we do report Radio Germany on 622 in the Portland Band.
So, yeah, I guess that's about it for this week.
Yep, and so I'll say cheerio, and
bye for now.
Well, as we had two transmitters now which were capable of doing the program, and we were only on one day a week for an hour, we thought it would be a good idea to run each transmitter for half the program, thus reducing the chances of being caught even further. We thought that being on the air for half an hour a week was about as slim a chance of being caught as you could possibly get. So we decided to see if we could work out a system whereby the first half of the program was transmitted by one transmitter at one site, and halfway through, the whole thing would be changed over to the second transmitter operating at a second site, and hopefully no one would notice the thing happening. And we did, in fact, develop a system whereby the complete program was recorded on two tapes, and each site had the complete program and a complete set of equipment. And the first site would transmit the first half, and at a predetermined point in the program, one transmitter was turned off and the second transmitter was turned on.
Yes, just top up my vodka there.
I'll pass me, you might as well, will you?
I remember those days very well. I used to sit there monitoring the first half of the show through all the fading and interference from next door's lawnmower, that sort of thing.
Don't forget, sometimes you couldn't hear it at all.
That's right. Well, I used to phase my programme tape in with the programme being received over the air. And at the predetermined point, which was about 10:30, when we had our theme going...
Ah, yes, the special theme, you notice, in the all the early programmes, especially at 10:30, wasn't just because we hadn't got anything else to put in, it was about a queuing point for
yes.
changeover.
It used to say, this is Radio Germany on 6230 kHz in the 49-metre band, and on the band part of it, one transmitter used to switch off and the other one used to switch on.
Amazing, isn't it?
Yes, and... at a long distance from the transmitter, of course, no one would notice. They would think the show would just continued normally. But very locally, anyone who had been trying to DF us, that is, locate our transmitting site, like the post office, in fact, the signal would suddenly disappear and start fading up and down like the clappers, because the two transmission sites were quite a long way away from each other.
Several miles apart, in fact.
Yeah, over 10 miles, in fact.
This, of course, worked very well, as long as, has already been said, the second site could hear the first programme, because you could then phase in the tape, you know, piece by piece, to make sure the programme was in approximately the right place. But if you couldn't hear the programme coming through, then, of course, you had to guess where the programme was, and this could lead, in certain circumstances, to very abrupt changes.
It did, but only on a couple of occasions, luckily. We could have phased it in more accurately over the phone, but we didn't think it was worth it. Now, I must admit that about 99% of the changeovers did work out really well, and we've got a couple of extracts, I think, coming up.
Yes, the one we have here listed anyway on the sheet is one which is made local to the first transmitter. So, in fact, you'll see the changeover exaggerated. This is not as it would be heard normally, but the recording is made very local to the first transmitter. So you'll hear the change in strength as the first one goes off and the second one comes on.
Sugar pie, honey, sugar pie,
Well, that's the Four Tops there on Radio Caroline from the year 1965, Gary Kemp on 199 metres.
Hello, I'm Rebecca, and I've got some Radio Gemini stickers, have you?
This is Radio Gemini on 6230 kHz in the 49-metre European band.
That was a recording of the changeover made relatively local to the first transmitter. To give you an idea of what it sounded like at a reasonable distance from both transmitters, here is a recording made in Braintree in Essex.
From the year 1965, Gary Kemp on 199 metres.
Hello, I'm Rebecca, and I've got some Radio Gemini stickers.
This is Radio Gemini on 6230 kHz in the 49-metre European band.
We now had a workable system, but we were still interested in the communication side, so we thought we'd try and get reports from a bit further away, so we ventured into the 31-metre band, and we did tests on 9423 kHz in the 31-metre band in February 1973, and we've got an extract now from a tape report sent in from Sweden.
Let me say a very good morning to those of you listening to our test transmissions now underway on the 31-metre band. If you could send in a reception report for our 31-metre band transmission, we would much appreciate it. It's to the 49-metre band transmission. And the mailing address for both of those is the same, of course. 50, Hempstead Row, Watford, New England.
We didn't seem to get very many reports for 31 metres. I think this was probably due to the fact that on 31 metres the skip is very large and the signal doesn't come down from the ionosphere until it's a considerable distance from the transmitter, which is very bad from our point of view because being low power, by the time it comes down it's pretty weak.
And they can't speak English either.
That is very true. So we got very few reports for 31 metres, and although it was worth doing, it certainly wasn't worth the effort and the risk of being caught to have that running every week. So we decided to turn our attention elsewhere. We were interested in finding a new channel, because on 6220 we were very close to R&I, and we were suffering considerable splatter from them. So we decided to look for new channels, but in the 49 metre band.
Well, we had by now obtained new stocks of crystals, which we were able to take apart, and we found that by various means of trial and error, with various wave meters and things, we were able to grind them to the frequency we required with, well, Ajax initially, but when we became more sophisticated, we used silicon carbide. And we chose a channel, a blank channel, in the 49 meter band, 6065 kilohertz. And for a few weeks, we did parallel transmissions on 6220 and 6065 kilohertz.
That was when we felt the risk of being caught for some reason was less, so we decided to run both transmitters for the complete hour.
Yes, well, from the reception reports we received for the 6065 test transmissions, it proved to us that if we did have a blank channel, such as 6065, reception could be improved remarkably. So we thought, well, we don't really want a frequency right in the band, because no one will be able to find us there. So we thought we'd experiment on other frequencies around 6220. And we experimented on various frequencies like 6225, 6230, 6235. And we've got an extract now from a test transmission we did on 6235 kilohertz from July the 1st, 1973.
Please retune now to 6235 kilohertz in the 49 meter band. This is Radio Gemini testing on 6235 kilohertz in the 49 meter band, and we'd very much appreciate reception reports giving us a comparison between our previous frequency of 6220 and the present one of 6235. If you haven't heard us before and this is the first time you've picked us up, then just a normal reception report would still be greatly appreciated. If you'd like to send them into our mailing address of 50 Hempstead Road, Watford, Hertfordshire in England, then you'll get a QSL card. That's 5050 Hempstead Road, Watford, Hertfordshire in England.
Well, we ended up on 6230 kilohertz, which seemed to be the most desirable channel at the time, and we had no trouble for the rest of the year, and we celebrated this fact with our first birthday show, which went out on November the 11th, 1973. And we have an extract of that now, recorded in Port Talbot in Wales. Well, good morning to you, everyone, listening to Radio Gemini. This is Radio Gemini on 6230 kilohertz. And it's rather a special show today because, believe it or not, we've been broadcasting now for 12 months.
Ah, very good. Yes, it is gratifying to think we've been on the air now for 12 months. And we'll get straight into the first record of today's programme from the Beatles. And coming in up in Seattle's birthday. Yes, well, things went okay, the birthday show went out, and we embarked upon our second year of transmission, hoping it would be as successful as the first. But unfortunately, 3 weeks after the birthday show, on December the 9th, in fact, the dreaded thing happened, and the post office turned up at site number one.
Oh dear, yes, well, site number one unfortunately belonged to me. I had up till now been doing the first half of the programme, up until about 10:30. And on that day, December 9th, everything seemed to have been going well, and not only acting as transmitter engineer, programme director, but also astute lookout, I noticed while performing my lookout duties that this horrible-looking vehicle had appeared outside the door with these two people in it. And they got out and started walking up and down the street with this sort of receiver thing in their hands with this earplug stuffed into their ear. And I thought, well, this doesn't usually happen on a Sunday morning. So I'm afraid I decided to panic, which is the usual thing to do. and I turned the equipment off, which is all very well from my point of view, but unfortunately we had this agreement that when the first site goes off, the second one automatically comes on again.
Yes, well, there I was, happily monitoring the show at my site with the program tape being phased in, and I noticed the signal as received by me suddenly went off the air. So the first objective was to continue the program, so my transmitter, which was already warmed up and going, just had the HT applied, and off it went, and the show continued. I received a phone call about 5 or 10 minutes later explaining the situation, and then had to make a decision whether to leave the program to run till 11 o'clock, the normal close down, or whether to panic and switch off. I decided, perhaps stupidly at the time, to continue the program, because our listeners come first, of course.
Oh, of course.
And the program continued until 11 o'clock. And I acted as lookout, but nothing suspicious seemed to happen my end, so I thought everything was okay. However, at about 11:30, while I was sort of congratulating myself,
drinking my coffee, in fact, on the sofa,
yes, thinking, well, we'd better work out something for next week, this rather strange-looking vehicle drew up outside my house, and this was accompanied by a couple of other strange-looking vehicles, and another one which wasn't quite so strange. We had a blue light on top,
police on the back.
Yes, and all these people started to march down the side of the house and proceeded to batter on the door.
This is when you said the famous statement, "Aha, something's up."
Yes. I sort of thought, by the way they acted, that they wanted to come in. But I didn't let them in, you see.
It seems the natural thing to do when someone wants to break down the door is you just keep quiet and they'll go away.
However, as these things happen when one lives with one's parents, they tend to open the door when someone's knocking on it. And unfortunately, these rather nasty-looking people under the direction of one Mr. Eric Gotts entered the house and proceeded to question me for about 3 hours. And this all resulted in a later appearance at the local magistrate's court, I'm afraid.
Yes, I don't think one can really go too much into the raid. I mean, raids like any other raid, it was just sort of the usual sort of raid.
Yes, all the equipment that we had, it didn't even have to be connected with the transmission. I mean, as long as it looked electronic, it was carted off. They took away about 3 carloads, in fact. Yes, four transmitters and tape machines and everything they could lay their hands on, which wasn't actually screwed to the wall, they took.
They even took something out of your car, didn't they?
Yes, they even took my disco equipment out of the car, but we won't go into that.
No, quite right.
Anyway, the fateful day of the court case came up. When was that? May the 9th, wasn't it?
6 months later. No, it couldn't have been 6 months later.
Yes, I think it was about 6 months later.
May the 9th, I think.
May the 9th. Yes. But anyway, that came into being, and we had to face the consequences, which we did. But in that 6 months, we weren't, in fact, idle.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. We decided, now, this is a great opportunity to make some money, but unfortunately...
Pay the fine, in fact.
Well, yes, true, but as usual with Radio Germany, all our plans never seem to come to...
fruition.
What's that? Oh, yes, that's a good word. They never seem to work out.
As well.
As well. And unfortunately, although we're still making a loss, what in fact happened in that short time will now be recounted.
Yes, we started a company called Ray Gem Enterprises. And the idea of this great event was to form a company which would sell free radio promotional material, which would, with the very small profit it made, go into running the associated station, Radio Gemini. And one of the first things that Ray Gem Enterprises produced was... the famous, by now famous anyway, Radio Gemini LP.
Yes, you'll hear an extract for the ad on the other side of this cassette.
Yes, and the Radio Gemini LP covered the history of offshore radio between 1964 and 1968, the old offshore stations, in fact.
I'd like to point out, really, at this point, that we're not really interested in making money. It's just the fact that everything that, that Radio Gemini does as such has been paid as a sort of a hobby, so any other money coming in is, of course, extremely useful.
It does go to help running the station, yes. Okay, well, as we said earlier, the court case did come into being, which is very sad, and we've got a short extract now from our on-the-spot reporter who happened to be at the local magistrate's court in question.
He just happened to have his cassette machine lying there.
Yes, it sort of stuck to his hand as he walked in.
Yeah. The prosecution arises under the
and officers acting on behalf of the Ministry of Post and Communications, who at that time responsible for the control of radio transmissions in this country, were attempting to track the station down. So on the 9th of December, they set up monitoring stations, and at about 10:40 a.m. they heard signals on the appropriate wavelength, which was 6.20 megahertz, giving the call sign radio Gemini. So the search warrant was obtained, and the officers visited the house where they interviewed this defendant. They searched the house, and in the garden, the rear of the house was a shed in which was a large quantity of radio equipment. And the defendant was cautioned and interviewed about this equipment, and he said he installed this equipment of this radio transmitter the day previously, which he's having constructed himself. He admitted that he had tested it that morning, and the first page he uses again. He was told that the transmissions had been traced to his address at 10:45 a.m.
Well, there we had a short extract from the Radio Gemini court case from May the 9th, 1974. Well, as you may have known, we did get fined £130 for operating Radio Gemini then. But one of the good things to come out of the court case, amazingly, was that the magistrate did seem to understand the 1949 Wireless Telegraphy Act, and that in fact it's only an offence to operate a transmitter, not to own one. So, in fact, out of the four transmitters confiscated, we did get three of them back, because only one of them was in operation. That was the good thing to come out of the court case.
Well, we had, in fact, planned to come back on the air after the court case, but we didn't quite know how this would arise. But we had made the next show before the court case had actually taken place. So it was all ready to go, and it was just a question of finding a new system, some new sites to transmit from. Which didn't prove too easy because, of course, we'd lost our permanent sites. We couldn't operate like this every week as we had done again. So we had to find a new site for each programme, which, of course, unfortunately meant we couldn't be on every single week. We had to do it every 6 or 8 weeks because we simply couldn't find enough sites. However, we found a site for the next one, and it went out on what was the date?
June the 9th.
June
the
9th.
1 month after the court case, in
fact. 1 month exactly after the court case, which is very good. And since that time, everything completely changed, and the whole system was more or less mobile and automatic.
Yes, in fact, it takes far more effort now to put each program out than it used to. In the old days, we have to put all the transmitters, modulators and everything into the car or other means of transport and move it about all over the country to the sites that we intend to use for that particular day. And we've got really refined now, in fact, because we think that the majority of the risk is actually getting caught and paying the fine. The equipment isn't that much of a loss because we can make some more equipment if necessary. So we tend to set it up a day or two in advance of the transmission date and put it all on time clocks, so the whole show goes out automatically and we can just wake up on a Sunday morning and tune into the transmission much as everyone else does.
The only drawback with this system, of course, is that one can't choose a channel. In the past, one used to listen to the channels and say, well, this one's clear, but this one isn't. And you could vary the frequency slightly. You'd still call the channel 6230, for example, but you could vary it by a few kc's just to give you a slightly better chance of being heard. But with it automatic, you have to select the channel the day before and simply hope that the channel is clear.
Well, things haven't changed much to the present day. So while we're in the Gemini studio, we thought we'd give you a quick rundown of the studio equipment as it is at the moment.
Okay, well, this leads on to me because I'm closest to the studio equipment.
You certainly are.
I certainly am. Okay, well, I think we mentioned at the very beginning of the documentary that the very first show was made not live as such, but by compiling the show from individual items. It's still done in exactly the same way, basically, namely that each show is made up from spoken word, of course, gems, records, what we call quips and IDs, things you slot in between anything else you happen to feel like putting in. Each individual item, they can be very short, only a few seconds, are in fact on various different tapes. So each single item has to be searched out and inserted in the right order, piece by piece, which takes a great deal of time. In the early days, we only had very sort of elementary equipment to actually do this with, and it meant stopping and starting one main tape recorder each time you wanted to insert a new item, which was extremely difficult, and it didn't give a very professional sound. You used to get bumps and clicks all over the place, and you certainly couldn't fade from one item to the other, like fading out of a record into an introduction. You used to have to stop the record and start with a big click in between. But since we started, we've got sort of a bit more professional, and we've acquired a new equipment.
Yes, the new systems.
The new systems. And at this present time, we record shows on a two-channel tape recorder, which enables you to do the same system, but instead of just bump starting, as we'd call it, one item onto the next, you record each individual item on the alternate track of the machine, so that you can overlap any item with any other item without erasing it previously. You then play back both channels together, and you get what we would like to call a professional sound, but it certainly isn't made with, how shall I say, little effort. There's a lot of effort goes into it. It's a bit of a con if you like to look at it that way.
It certainly makes it sound as though it was done live and all the crossfading was done live, but in fact it wasn't. It makes us sound professionals when in real life we're really not. Okay, well, just a brief rundown of the equipment I think is all that's needed now.
Finish off the documentary.
That's it, just to finish it off. Well, of course, the heart of the studio is a couple of Revox A77s controlled from a custom-built mixing desk, which automatically controls both the Revoxes. And in addition to that, we've got a couple of SP25 record decks, a Garrard 301 record deck, other associated tape machines, a Brenel, a couple of Grundig, Philips, and the main monitor amp is an Armstrong.
Okay, well, that's about it, really, for the Radio Gemini technical documentary.
And I would like to point out that should any member of the Home Office Radio Services Department be listening to this tape, then Radio Gemini did, in fact, cease to exist as from yesterday.